guitar up.
One,
turn
two,
that guitar
three.
Up.
Redbeard here in the studio with the Red Rocker, Sammy Hagar, marking two significant anniversaries in his solo career.
I was in a rental car that wouldn't go much faster than 55 miles an hour. I was driving from Albany, New York about 2 o'clock in the morning, burnt from all the travel, burnt. cops stopped me for doing 62 on a four-lane road with no one else in the world. There wasn't even a UFO in sight. Then the guy gave me a ticket. I was doing 62. He said, well, we give tickets for 60, over 60 around here. And I swear, I can't drive 55. I went, all right. I grabbed the paper and a pen, and I swear the guy's writing the ticket. I was writing the lyrics. I've gotten more letters, I can tell you, thousands of letters that their mother, their father, their brother, their sister, their best friend, or the person themselves saying, you saved my life. I can't tell you that means more to me than any song I've ever written. Everyone kind of remembers. So I Never Say Goodbye album that I made with Eddie playing bass right after 5150. Royalties off Van Halen records went to Geffen, the other, so what, like 5 million records for the guy on 3 records. He wasn't about to let one of his biggest artists just go. Well, thanks, Sammy. No problem. I love you, buddy. Not anyone would do that. Yo, this is Sammy Hagar in the studio with Redbeard.
Sam Roy Hagar, named after his maternal grandfather, left his boyhood hometown of Fontana, California, for the San Francisco Bay Area. There, around 1972, Sammy Hagar first saw Ronnie Montrose playing electric guitar in Edgar Winter's popular band and soon approached Montrose for a job. This would be the opening bell in a long series of bouts with a four-decade career for the feisty, driven, gregarious Sammy Hagar, who grew up a fighter. Quite literally.
My father was a professional fighter. He was bantamweight. He was, top contender, fought for the titles quite a few times, but he fought a great fighter, one of the most famous fighters in history, Manuel Ortiz. He fought him 7 times, and if it wasn't for Manuel Ortiz, my dad would have obviously been bantamweight champ. But so he always said, well, my son's going to be bantamweight. It's kind of like a Ray Mancini kind of a deal. Ray's father always, wanted his son to be champ, and Ray wanted to do that for his father, and he did it. I never did, because I, as soon as I got a car when I turned 16, I kind of said, see you, Dad, and I was out the door starting, to party and stuff. But I wanted to be a fighter for a long time, and I grew up with boxing. It's still my favorite sport. I watch it constantly. I still train once in a while like a fighter. I don't know, I've kind of been a fighter kind of guy, in my life as well, it's coming from nothing and poor family and so forth. I kind of related to fighting for anything you needed, If it were confrontation man-to-man, well, you duked it out, If it were a mental combat, well, you tried to outsmart the guy and so forth. And in my case now, you try to outsing the competition and do a better show than the competition, So it's still the same game to me. It just I don't get hit as much.
Suckers walk, money talks, but it can't touch my 3 lock box.
Yeah.
Son, the Holy Ghost, to the Trinity, a raise a toast. Ah, yeah. 1, 2, 3, lock box. 1, 2, 3, lock box. 1, 2, 3, lock box. 1, 2, 3, lock box.
But it can't touch my three-lock box. I love that intro, man. I think I kind of capitalized. I can't say I invented, because Black Dog, Led Zeppelin, had the first song that I remember that started with the singing. You know, hey, mama, say the way, mama. So I kind of stole that with Love or Money and did it with three-lock box and did it with High Hopes. And there's been a couple other ones, I think. I like those songs that start off with a vocal. You kind of get your point right straight off, right? You know, let's get something, it's like, yeah, let's get something straight here, okay?
Whap!
Sammy Hagar talking about the title song to his seventh solo album, 1982's Three Lock Box. With only the two obscure Montrose albums as a professional brief resume before embarking on a solo career in the mid-70s, going it alone seems to be the hardest path that Hagar could have chosen. What ensued was a grueling, decade-long period of constant recording and touring, playing a different town every night. The unglamorous life on the road of the opening act, always the bridesmaid, but never the bride.
It's kind of a bummer, but when I hit the stage, I tell you, Corpus Christi, Texas, one time, my first time I tried to headline there, I did about 700 or 800 people out of about 11,000. And it was really pressing. I was going, wow, why? What happened to this place? You know, why is nothing happening for me here? You know, you wonder and it makes you feel bad. But, man, you know, I went out on stage and I swear, it's one of the greatest shows I've ever done in the state of Texas. That usually gets me up for it. I'm a fighter. We back to your first questions to me. You know, I'm up for the challenge, man. It's like when that happened to me, I went, these 700 people are going to be the happiest people in this city. When they go home tonight, they're gonna have seen the best rock and roll show I could ever give anybody and they'll ever see again, you know? And that's the attitude I would always take. For those that came out for it, I'd give them that 75,000 seater show for you know, that's just the way I feel. I would never go out and do, you know, half the show with half the house. That's probably half what my reputation was all about, why I became a live act before I could really sell, you know, giant record sales, because I think my fans, they knew, you know, put the money down, you're going to get it.
Yeah.
from 1982's Three Lock Box. Your Love is Driving Me Crazy peaked at number 13 for Sammy Hagar's first big hit after almost a decade of struggle. Crucial in his career development were Hagar's outdoor festival performances in St. Louis and repeatedly at the annual Texas Jams, a series of huge multi-group summer rock festivals in the Dallas Cotton Bowl Stadium between 1978 and 1990.
Those events, Texas Jam, were when I was first starting out, the first time I opened the Texas Jam for 70,000 people or whatever, I came out and did really good. The people just, you know, they were in the mood, man. First band out, you know, and I came out, tore it up, and made a reputation for myself in all of Texas and even going as far as Oklahoma City and the surrounding states. Became, you know, Sammy Hagar favorites because I was always at the jam and I was always promoting the jams. I thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever done. The first time I played a big show like that, I mean, I was dying. I'm going, this is the greatest thing could ever be. This is all I want to do, you know, is play these big shows. I felt like I could connect with those 75, 80,000 people on stage. And it worked for me because that only state in America that I'd play 11 shows was in the state of Texas. And I could play any town that had anywhere from 8 to 20,000 seat place and sell it out, you know. And that was early on in my career. And I know it was because of the jams. So many people had seen me, and it was like I was a household name there. And before anywhere else as far as the whole state goes. But now, then you got St. Louis, where I got to play on a stadium show there, same thing, and it worked for me there too, and that became St. Louis, and just that city though. I used to play St. Louis and do two nights at the Checker Dome, yeah, about two nights, about 35,000 people, and go about 400 miles down the road and do about 3,500 people. It was amazing, just a phenomenon that happened there. And I attribute those kind of things to the big shows because those were the cities. Happened for me in San Francisco as well. They used to have Day on the Green there. And I played three or four of those, worked up to the headliner as well. And the same thing. San Francisco has always been a huge city for me. And the places where I got to play those big outdoor shows, they seemed to be the markets where the first ones to where I became big, to where I do multiple nights in the Coliseums. And I still love playing stadium shows more than anything. They're my favorite things to do.
Remember the Heroes is a heartfelt song on Sammy Hagar's Three Lock Box album that features a vocal duet with Loverboy's Mike Reno. Next, Sammy scores his first knockout. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and hear more from Sammy live at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Sammy Hagar on the 30th anniversary of Three Lock Box.
Yo, this is Sammy Hagar in the studio with Redbeard.
Thanks, buddy. In 1984, Sammy Hagar answered the bell and came out swinging with his strongest set of songs to date, including the superbly crafted The Two Sides of Love.
Sort of a pop tune, but very, very soulful, very true to life. You know, at that time I was having some problems with, you know, my ex-wife, and who's now my ex-wife, but my wife, and, you know, she was just being very lonely, and because I was on tour most of the time, I can't blame her. Nothing, you know, I'm not criticizing her in any way, I'm saying, but that's so, she was giving me some problems about touring so much and about working so much, but, you know, I'm driven, you know. So I wrote that song kind of, you know, it's what it is. It's two sides of love. You know, it's so easy to fall in love, and it comes naturally, and but making it last is really what's hard. And it's after the infatuation and the spark and the energy of first meeting is gone after 2 or 3 years, if it lasts that long, then you start hitting the other side of love, which comes to the pain and the heartache and the pulling teeth trying to get things done and stay together. And that's what that song's about. I think it's a pretty cool lyric. I like that song.
Thank you.
Two Sides of Love was the first of a 1-2 combination punch from VOA that included Sammy Hagar's most memorable song, I Can't Drive 55, inspired not by some exotic Ferrari or Corvette sports car, but by a much more common and relatable ride.
I was in a rent-a-car that wouldn't go much faster than 55 miles an hour. I was on my way back from Africa. I did a safari for 3 months throughout Africa, and I was on a really great vacation and after a three-lock box, and I was traveling for 24 hours. I got to Albany, New York. I got to New York City, changed planes, Albany, New York, got in a rental car. I had a place in Lake Placid at that time, a little log cabin. I used to go there and write. My little boy, Aaron, at that time went to North Country School when I was on tour. We'd go there and see him. It was just really great, real cool getaway. But it took 2.5 hours to drive there from Albany. I was driving from Albany, New York about 2 o'clock in the morning, burnt from all the travel, burnt, the cops stopped me for doing 62 on a 4-lane road with no one else in the world. There wasn't even a UFO in sight. I did see Elvis hitchhiking earlier. I didn't pick him up, though I should have, but then the guy gave me a ticket. I was doing 62. He said, we give tickets for 60, over 60 around here. And I swear, I just said, I can't drive 55. I went, all right. I grabbed the paper and a pen, and I swear the guy's writing the ticket. I was writing the lyrics. I've told the story before, and anyone that's heard it, they know that it hasn't changed one bit. Either I'm a great liar, got a great memory, or I'm telling the truth. Guess which one? So seriously, I got to the Lake Placid, my house, and you know, I had a guitar set up there and stuff, and a little tape recorder. I wrote that song right on the spot, burnt. I mean, like, I could barely keep my eyes open. I just traveled out, 24 hours of travel. I still wrote that song. It just wrote itself. I didn't write that song.
We'll be right back. Like, I had this situation happen to me, you know, because if I can't drive 55, this happens all the time. So I'm in the back of a limo at 2 o'clock in the morning in Nebraska, in Omaha, and two cars come up to this light next to us, and they're just revving up, man, and they just burn rubber off, and they start drag racing down the street in the middle of the, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm cracking up. I'm going, this is great. I roll down the window. I tell the limo driver, punch it, catch these guys. You know, whatever you got to do, you catch him. And he went after him, and they, you know, had to stop at a light. And we come up, and I'm going, yes, I'm giving the guys all these fights. I said, this is badass. And then they really start getting on it. So that night, you know, the next day we played, and I go up on stage, and I'm rapping. I'm saying, you ain't going to believe this, man. But I was doing my acoustic solo, so I cranked an electric guitar that night. I said, this is in honor of those two guys that are drag racing, man. And I told the story, and I busted into it. The next day, the guy in the paper says, you know, he can't believe this, that I was such a phony, such a fake, that I walk on stage and think that the people are gullible enough to believe a story like that so I can play my hit song. And I was pissed, and I'm still pissed, because I've never prefabricated a story in my life. Well, in the early days, and on 5150 tour, I got it a lot. Not necessarily about my raps, but the people that wanted to go after me. And it bothered me. And I can tell you, man, it really got me down. I would get mad. And sometimes it would even hurt my performance the next night. I would go out and be a little bit paranoid about what I was doing and not quite be as spontaneous and open, because I would think, oh, I better not do that. I better not say that. And I would start, it would hurt my performance a little bit. I mean, very little, to where no one might notice. But to me, I didn't feel comfortable. And if you don't feel comfortable on stage, man, it's a long haul, brother. Let me tell you, when you're standing up there in front of a bunch of people and you're uncomfortable, whew, that's a long night. But when you're thinking about it and you're worrying about it and you're uncomfortable, man, that set can last for days. It's hard work then. It's the only time it's work.
Still to come, Sammy returns for the 25th anniversary of his highest charting solo album called I Never Said Goodbye. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and hear the exclusive live Sammy Hagar performance at InTheStudio.net. I'm Redbeard with the Red Rocker, Sammy Hagar.
Yo, this is Sammy Hagar in the studio with Redbeard.
Thanks again, Sam. After 10 years of struggle, Sammy Hagar's VOA album breaks big, selling multi-platinum. The supporting headlining tour is an arena sellout, even doing multiple nights in his strongholds of popularity. The VOA album and tour success were the culmination of all that hard work. So when Eddie Van Halen calls and invites Hagar to a Van Halen rehearsal after their popular frontman split, how long did it take Sammy Hagar to call his manager to decide to forego his newfound solo success?
I called up Ed Leffler and said, Ed, I'm doing it. He goes, Sam, you're crazy. We're going to have so much trouble, man. Don't you realize you got contracts with Geffen? They got contracts with Warner Brothers, and they probably got trouble with the old singer and blah, you know. And I'm going, hey, I don't care. I want to do it. Make it happen, you know. And Ed was a genius. And, you know, they hashed it out. You remember, everyone kind of remembers. So I Never Said Goodbye album that I made with Eddie playing bass right after 5150, we made that as, you know, for Geffen. I said, here's a freebie, you know, and I made him one more record, and that was part of the deal, and he got a percentage of Warner Brothers royalties off Van Halen records, went to Geffen, and, you know, they just worked it out, and, you know, it was a tough deal, believe me, it really was. I mean, you had a guy that I had just sold, you know, with VOA, 2 million records, and the other, you know, so what, like 5 million records for the guy on 3 records, and, you know, he wasn't about to let one of his biggest artists just go. Well, thanks, Sammy. You know, no problem. I love you, buddy. You know, not anyone would do that, you know. I'm still so determined. I don't know. It just built into me. My father, I think, built that in me. My father became an alcoholic and died in a park, and was very humiliating to me in my hometown because of that. I mean, I loved my father, and he loved me and all that. But after my parents got divorced and my father just went straight downhill, and he just lived in the streets. He became a street person, and, you know, my friends would say, man, I saw your dad the other day, man, he looked pretty rough. I'd be so embarrassed, you know. It really hurt my heart, and, you know, I was poor. My mother was trying to raise 4 kids and so forth, and, you know, I wanted to be something and somebody, and I never wanted to ever, you know, I felt like my dad let me down when that happened, and I was determined that in my life I would never ever let anyone down, and yeah, I'm still kind of driven by that.
We'll be right back. reaching out for someone. An empty heart takes a little to fill. It's so much easier to push instead of pull.
I love that song. I've gotten more letters, I can tell you, thousands of letters. And, you know, that doesn't seem like maybe much when you sell millions of records. But thousands of letters of people that their mother, their father, their brother, their sister, their best friend, or the person themselves have written me letters saying, you saved my life, or you saved my friend's life, or it saved my daughter's life, saved my son's life. It's, you know, that song that I can't tell you that means more to me than any song I've ever written. Someone, a teenager maybe, or let's say her friend was, you know, tried to commit suicide and was in the hospital and, you know, bummed out, and parents bought him a little CD player or something, some headphones, and they're in there with stitches and maybe, you know, drug overdose or whatever. And their friend came in with my new record and they heard that song and it made them think how stupid they were, and it made them want to just live and made them want to change their life. And that was the most common one, that or someone was going to commit suicide and a friend said, oh, you got to hear this song. And I mean, it sounds corny even, but it's really true. I got thousands of letters like that, and that's not corny stuff. That's real life, and that does more to flatter yourself and make you feel like, boy, if I could just do that for one person, that's enough in a life. But to have, you know, that, just what you save one person's life, you know how good that makes you feel. So I feel kind of like a good guy after that. And that song was another song that it was kind of a pretty big hit, but it's probably the biggest hit on this record, actually. But it could have been, it should be used for public service, and I would give the rights up and everything else if they wanted to use it for any kind of message like that. You know, it's a good song.
Sammy Hagar was the lead singer of Van Halen at the time of recording his contractually obligated solo album in 1987. So he enlisted Eddie Van Halen's help on recording it. What virtually no one else outside of Van Halen knew was that at the time, both Eddie and Alex Van Halen were alcoholics, as was their father. Thankfully, Alex would get clean and sober, but Eddie had struggled badly for many years. I asked Sammy Hagar if his own father's battle with alcoholism helped Sam with some insight into his bandmates' struggles.
Most definitely. You know, when you see your father at 53, you know, drink himself to death in a park, you know, he died under a park bench, man, I'm not joking. And it's really, you know, like I said, first thing I said is that's never going to happen to me. I mean, you know, it's like, okay, you know, I see it now. I see where certain things lead you. And, you know, and I've used drugs in my life lightly, casually, you know, on a party level and sociable level, you might say, you know, just to hang in there with the pals and see what it's all about and all that. And, you know, if that's your kind of recreation, entertainment, you know, you got to know what you're really into here. And when it becomes more than recreation, then you got problems, and big problems, problems that can kill you, problems that can kill other people, problems that can just take you right down, and that's what alcohol or any of those things do. And if you can't keep them under control, if you're one of those kind of people that can't keep them under control, I mean, you just can't do them. I know plenty of people like that. They can't take one drink. If they take one drink, they got to keep drinking until they pass out or until they do something so stupid someone knocks them out. And same with drugs. There's some people they just can't stop. And if you're that kind of person, man, don't even start, because it's a one-way street. And I've seen where it leads with friends and with my own father. And yeah, I mean, that's easy. A blind man could have seen that. You know, what I saw, you know, made it real easy for me, my whole family.
One of the most memorable songs from 1987's I Never Said Goodbye solo album was Sammy Hagar's Eagles Fly, a favorite of Top Gun fighter pilots in the U.S. military. Hagar recalls that the song was inspired by a stunning vista from the American West.
I lived in this place up in the high desert that I used to go to once in a while, and I just was sitting out there and at about 4,700 feet with this huge panorama, this gorgeous desert below, and an eagle is flying around up there. It's almost verbatim. And, you know, I felt like I was being born. Like, I can't explain it. It made me remember. The whole situation was so spiritual, being where I was, that it made me remember or feel what it was like being born. It made me at least think about it, to where I went, can you imagine when you're a baby and you're inside, you know, your mother, there you are, and you're in this water and this fluid and liquid, and she's feeding you through her body, and then all of a sudden you're out, you know, the umbilical cord is cut, and you are slapped, you know, dipped in water or whatever, and all of a sudden you take your first breath of air, and all of a sudden it's like, that's got to be the biggest transition ever in anything. And I'm thinking, wow. And that's kind of what I started feeling like, you know, at this moment. And that's a very spiritual song. That is a song that was a gift, I can tell you. It's just one of those things you go, oh, I didn't write that song, man. I couldn't grasp that vision and that thought and hang on to it long enough to finish a song ever again in my life. You know, maybe I could, but those things only happen to you very rarely. And that was just, you get a glimpse of another life or another dream or another, you know, I don't know, you know, you just get those glimpses. And when you can hang on to it long enough to write a song about it, that's a special song. Every time I sing that song on stage, I did it acoustically, I can tell you right now, the whole band, we all do, when we play that song, you get goosebumps every night.
Sunday morning, 9 a.m. I saw fire in the sky. I felt my heart pound in my chest. I heard an eagle cry. I'm not afraid to die.
Exhilarating Eagles Fly from Sammy Hagar's number 14 charting 1987 solo album, I Never Said Goodbye, as well as Hagar's New York Times best-selling autobiography in 2011, Red, My Uncensored Life in Rock. I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guest, Sammy Hagar. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2012, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and hear much more from the biggest names in rock at inthestudio.net.